thing, just listening to everybody so far this morning is, I think that stands out in my mind more than anything in starting this conversation is how different on some level what I'm involved in, I think, is compared to some of the experience of the other panelists. Just to give you some sense of that is, I mean, my journalism background started in May of this year. So, I mean, before then, I mean, I was sitting where you are. I worked for over the past, you know, more than 20 years on health policy issues all across the spectrum, from public health to Medicaid to Medicare. I mean, I crunched the numbers. I was the analyst. I worked in Congress. Worked in Department of Health and Human Services. I worked for Tobacco-Free Kids. I worked for public relations firms. I've kind of seen healthcare from a lot of different perspectives, but until recently, not from the perspective of a news organization. And part of what I want to talk to you about today really is trying to. I hope at least the first part of this doesn't sound too much like or seem too much like a commercial, but it's important, I think, to describe for you, to tell you kind of what's different about what we're doing and really how do you get our attention. Because I think it is different. I mean, having sat in the policy world for a number of years, I honestly didn't really spend a lot of time talking and thinking about business issues all that much. And this has really opened up a very new way for me to think about issues. And we really tie things together very differently. We have teams of editors, reporters, and analysts, whether it's policy analysts, economists, financial analysts, and blending that all together into both kind of enterprise reporting, but very in-depth analysis for the customers of our service. So just hopefully this will be I'll get detailed enough for you so you have a good sense of what we're talking about. No conflicts to report. I just want to give you a little video that we've done with regard to Bloomberg government that just kind of encapsulates kind of what we're all about, and then I'll go into a little bit more detail.
Getting information from Washington isn't a problem. Getting all of it, making sense of it, connecting the dots and pinpointing the impact in real time. These are the challenges. Bloomberg government helps you do it all with speed and ease you never thought possible. 30 years ago, Bloomberg revolutionized the financial world, delivering trusted intelligence to Wall Street's fingertips. Now, Bloomberg government offers this extraordinary power so to meet where business and government converge. You'll know what happens as it happens, and what it means in your world. With expert analysis and detailed breakdowns all in one place, you'll be able to turn information into action like never before and stay ahead of what comes next. Bloomberg government has changed the game.
Okay. The service itself is a new service. Again, it's very simple. The concept is very easy to understand. I mean, it's about and you have to know kind of who Bloomberg's audience and customers are. We started out as a financial news reporting business. Bloomberg government is kind of expanding on that to really connect, to explain for the business audience what it is that government is doing, whether it's at the federal, state, local level. We're doing a little bit of international as well, but really translating for folks into very simple but not simplistic ways what is it that the government is doing in healthcare. You know, there's just been so much happening that, you know, to make everybody's head spin, how do we make this digestible, translate it for people, make it transparent for companies and businesses that have to make investment decisions? And then conversely, how do we explain the business impacts of what government did for the policymakers, for the advocates, for the government officials, for the executive branch officials? You know, how do we interact between both of those worlds and explain to them what is happening in a hopefully as an objective, unbiased manner as possible, so that, you know, people can grasp in very specific ways what is going on. We started the service with healthcare just because there was so much going on. We're going to be fully up and running this new division with, I think, up to about 10 industry verticals, including, in addition to healthcare, finance, energy, defense, technology. We're going to have about 300 total editors, reporters, and analysts in this new division. So it's a big investment by Bloomberg, but one that we think is, there's a lot of organizations that simply don't have the capacity, but there's such a vital need for information out there, and we're hoping we can be helpful in that regard. No surprise, I mean, why Washington, why we're doing this? There's just so much happening. Obviously, just last week, there was a few changes that happened or that will be unfolding in the coming months. I mean, when we launched this over the past, you know, starting over a year ago, there was so much happening, especially in healthcare, but also in financial services. There's a lot of moving parts. People don't get in the weeds anymore. It's a hard thing to do. It often isn't very interesting. It's not terribly sexy. But if you're an investor, if you're a business, if you're a company, or if you're a government official, people need to understand and know the details of what is happening. I mean, you have to go through those regulations. I mean, just last week, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued in one day, you know, these three huge final rules totaling, it's like 5,000 or 6,000 pages of rules in one day. And, you know, what does that mean for people? I mean, people, there's no way people can process and digest that kind of information. Hopefully that's something we have, because we have kind of analytic expertise, the understanding of the mechanics of the different areas, and then we can blend that with the reporting and the ways to communicate that effectively for people. You know, from the business community, when we were building this product, you know, they told us, you know, they want insights, they want comprehensive, integrated information. What are all the pieces of the puzzle that we need to know so I can be informed? You have to think of, I mean, our audience, it's members of Congress and their new staffs and the administration and the consulting firms and the law firms, but it's also the chief executives, the chief financial officers. It's the analysts within those companies. It's people who have to, you know, translate what the heck does health reform mean to Tenet Healthcare or Tenet Hospital Corporation or to Aetna or to whomever. How do they take that information and figure out what does it mean? And hopefully, and I'll show you some examples in a few minutes of some of the things ways we've tried to do that. This is just an example of, these are kind of 6 or 7 questions that we need to ask for every single story in terms of to consider it. Doesn't mean they all have to be incorporated into the story, but it's how will revenue for the industry or business be affected and why? How will the cost structure for the industry be affected and why? What's the likely impact on profitability? You know, and so on. Not every story is going to incorporate these things. Sometimes all we need to do is to be able to talk more about the policy piece than the business impact. We just have to be able to connect the dots of, okay, these are the main companies in this particular field that might be affected, and be able to talk about how much revenue they have, what is their market share, what is their share prices. But this is the bigger policy thing that we think is important for you to know about, and the details of it. A very specific example I just wanted to show you about, this is something that's actually happening right now that I'm working on. HHS is going to be releasing Healthy People 2020, probably sometime late November, early December, you know, setting up all the new goals for the country in terms of different health measures. What does that mean from a business standpoint? What I want to be able to do is kind of go connect the dots for people, and specifically what I'm interested in doing. I'm not sure if I can actually do it yet. I'm still trying to collect the data for two big measures, for reducing smoking prevalence, adult smoking prevalence, and reducing adult obesity prevalence. For those, whatever those goals are in 2020, what are the two most prominent or prevalent conditions, illnesses or diseases associated with each of those, smoking and obesity? What are then from that, take it down a layer. What are the two most common treatments associated with those conditions? Let's go another layer. Who provides the medications, the medical devices, the services to to provide those treatments? And then who are the companies to do that? So that in the end, if there was a X percent reduction in smoking prevalence, if adult smoking prevalence went from 20.6% today to 15% in 2020, what does that actually mean for the companies that provide chemotherapy? What does that mean for the hospitals that, you know, like it or not, they rely on people being sick for their revenue? You know, it's the business model. But how does that affect things? If people are either quitting, or they're being prevented from, or they're not initiating smoking, what does that mean? Who are the winners and losers from a business standpoint? And it's just starting to think about that from where you're sitting. How is what you're doing affecting the businesses in your communities, in your states, or at the national level? That's going to get our attention in order to be able to discuss it and talk about it. So it's a little bit different. I know, I mean, this is not really how I thought when I was sitting where you're sitting, but if we're sufficiently interested and they were constantly looking for stories, and to be able to communicate this and bring it down from 30,000 feet to the brick and mortar on the ground. That's what we want to be able to do. Just a couple very quick examples of some stories that we've done. In part of the health reform bill included a number of new preventive service mandates that are tied to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations. If you're rated an A or a B, you're now covered under private health insurance. We wanted to say, okay, let's take one of those services. What does it mean? What did that? In this instance, we looked at the smoking cessation coverage. What does that actually mean for? And we looked at drug makers. For the drug makers who make GlaxoSmithKline, for Pfizer, for the generic manufacturers, what does this actually mean when you eliminate, when one, you have a mandate that everybody has it, and two, you now have eliminated cost sharing associated with it, so presumably the financial barrier from a consumer standpoint is gone. What does that mean in terms of the incremental benefit to the drug makers? So it's trying to go through that. So we did a story related to that. You know, we have great graphics that we can incorporate, you know, things around market share. We were able to project over a five-year period what the incremental revenue changed with a number of different factors. And one thing I can show this to people if people want. In the analyses that we do, we have a word you hear at Bloomberg all the time is transparency. In the studies that we do and the models that we create, we create it so that you can replicate it. We're not going to say whether it's good or bad. We're not going to cast a judgment on it. But it's information for you to then, if you want to spin it, if you want to play with it, whether you're a business, government, whomever, you can actually, you know what we did. You know the assumptions we used. You know the sources we used. You know, you can disagree with some of those, but at least we put it out there for people to think about. And at the time we did this, some of the analysts get to do these things called insights or commentaries. And one of the things, at least when I was at Tobacco Free Kids, that always irked me about tobacco control was the adult prevalence reports you get from CDC actually exclude a whole bunch of audiences from the figure. I mean, and it turns out of all the stories I've done in the past 6 months, this one got some of the most feedback, it seemed, because people are like, I didn't know that, because it excludes basically institutionalized populations, so it excludes anybody, and also it's all civilian, so it includes everybody from the military, it excludes veterans, it excludes prison populations, it excludes anybody with a substance abuse or mental health problem, and just by our estimate, as best that we could figure out, you're leaving out about at least 4.5 million people. Or almost about 5 to 10%, you're underreporting the actual smoking prevalence in the country by about 5 or 10% as a result of this exclusion. And what are the business implications of that from an investment standpoint? If I'm Pfizer, where do I distribute my marketing and my efforts to get people to use my product? And from a policy standpoint, I bet you most people who set policy around tobacco control don't know this is a fact. They don't know this is excluded because they don't understand the methodologies. So it's trying to make those types of things more apparent for people. Just these white papers that we do where we drill down. These things can be 10, 15, 20, 50 pages long, very detailed, very in-depth in terms of, this one was the one we did on drug makers. Actually, we're going to be releasing the companion to this probably within the next week, which is actually going to look at the business impact on health insurers, but the smoking cessation mandate. In terms of, you know, who are among the top five publicly traded health insurers, which are WellPoint, Humana, Aetna, HealthNet, and United Health. You know, based on their market share, what would we expect to see in terms of the impact? Other ones we've done, we've looked at, there was a proposal by Senator Boxer earlier this year about mandating new nurse staffing ratios in hospitals to a California standard. What would have been, what would be the impact on the hospital industry, on nurses, on labor pricing issues and things like that? So when we cover a lot of ground in terms of what we're trying to do. And, you know, it's very exciting what we're doing. I think it is, at least. It is different, but I think it's important for you to know there's other news outlets out there beyond, I think, some of the more traditional ones that you're used to interacting with. So, in terms of communicating with some of the key decision makers, government officials, and business leaders in ways that you maybe never have had the opportunity to, you know, I think we're a possible vehicle for doing that. If, you know, come to us, you know, we love data. And we have the people who understand it, who can work with it, who can come to their own conclusions with it, whether it's your own studies or raw information or surveillance information, or what have you. I mean, we are not going to cover, you know, the Diabetes Prevention Month issues. I mean, we're not going to do that. You know, we might talk about diabetes in the context of, you know, how it impacts, you know, business investment decisions, who, you know, and things like that. But we're not going to cover kind of the issue du jour in terms of, you know, this is whatever prevention week or prevention month and things of that sort. It's more specific than that. But I think it provides a lot of opportunity for you as far as issues to think about in terms of coverage, and I'd be happy to talk to anybody if you have any questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Matt. We're going to open it up to questions, and please step forward to the microphone if you have a question.
Well, it's more of a comment. I was actually walking out because I have my own presentation, but when I heard my hometown mentioned, I thought I'd set this up. When I heard my hometown mentioned, I thought I should stay. So Judith and you and I are kindred spirits because I came to this presentation to understand health a little bit better. So who am I? I'm Dr. Stephen Martin, Chief Operating Officer, Cook County. And I had to kind of get my notes because, as you were saying, your frustrations, I was just bubbling on my end. Okay. So I have to talk quickly, say some points. I need to get to my session. I welcome you to come to my session at 12:30. It may interest you. So I'll give a card for you. I had to give you a card because I'm leaving at a point. Also, in the audience with me is Mr. Jim Nelson, who's the Executive Director of the Illinois Public Health Association. 70-year-old organization, so you got us both our attentions here. So let me go right in. The atmosphere, you're absolutely correct. I think only you and I and Jim can probably relate to the Chicago media market. So I'm just going to leave it there, let it settle there. But pitching stores are very difficult, particularly in our market, for us. You're right. I see my group put out the number of press releases out with diabetes. But we also pitching stories to our media markets, and we never get lifted. For example, just a week ago, I pitched a story for the release for community prevention work, $4 million. I had one camera there, and that was from the Univision.
What was it for?
For the release of $4 million for the community prevention to work grant from our stimulus money. This is to affect chronic disease change. And it's not even on you, Judith. That's not it. When I walked in and did that press release, I couldn't believe that. First of all, the first story in terms of that our area receiving $60 million didn't get covered correctly. We were trying to affect change, and we didn't even get it. Univision is a great channel. Univision for us is the Latino channel on our cable. Okay, so I didn't even get to the major market yet, because we were so interested in who's going to be our next governor, which I really didn't care, because people are dying. So we have a challenge on both of our ends to kind of share the rights over to you and learn how to hear and communicate better to our audience. Some other pitch stories I'd like to just throw out there since I've been tenure, I would like to throw out there. One is the issue of public health workforce. We heard that nursing shortage. I can't hire epidemiologists because they're not sexy on the county budget. I can't hire a health educator because it's not sexy in the county budget. But if one of my municipalities says they're putting up a fire station, we can raise all the money we want. So we have this tension. I don't know how to break it. That's one story I would love to figure out how we communicate that, not only to our stakeholders, but to our appropriators. Other story, this is the $60 million. There is the Northern Public Health Consortium, made up of 11 counties. And we've been doing some wonderful work around regional preparedness, regional health issues, because we figured out that, you know what, we can't do this alone. But we've pitched that story, but we can't get it lifted. Another pitch. For me, since I've been in tenure as the health director for 8 years, I've convinced as part of health reform that one great story I would love to figure out how to tell a story is I believe that there should be one county health authority in the county of Cook. In the county of Cook, we have six. City of Chicago, my four municipals, and myself. When I give a message, it doesn't get lifted, but if the city puts a message in, it gets lifted. And then I have suburban residents call me saying, well, why can't I get the city services? So we have confusing messages going back and forth. But on to the point about one county health authority, simply because for our survivability and strength going forward as part of health reform, that's the only way we would survive. That's my personal observation. And I'll leave that. So what I would like to do is challenge you and I, and challenge this forum, that I would, and all of you, we're in DC next year? Yes. Let's figure out what we can do and report back to this same group, you and I together.
Yay.
Figure out how we break through that and do the kind of stories you're interested in, the kind of stories I want to do.
Let me tell you, just throw something out there. I appreciate everything you're saying. I had the amazing experience of the federal funds came down for federal qualified health centers. Access Community Health in Chicago is the largest chain of federally qualified health centers in the country. They got an extra $100 million. I went to my editor, I said, I think we should cover it. She said, I don't think so. Now, that just raises issues of, even if you have an educated health reporter like me, what are the layers above them? And what are their values in these media outlets? And you and I can do all the productive talking in the world and perhaps still not make a difference. So there are just layers and layers of how decisions get made that are, we could spend days talking. But I keep up any challenge.
Wonderful. So I'm leaving and I'm at 12:30. And then we'll call A talking about migration, gentrification, and displacement and changing the face of suburban America related to suburban jungle. So, so thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Freelance a lot, even though I'm on the Berkeley, is that there's kind of this perception that you send the story idea out and there's someone who's actually made an active decision that we don't want to cover your specific story. Now, it really usually doesn't work that way. What happens is, as Judy says, when you're at a media organization, you're getting hundreds of these things a day. It's most likely, in many cases, it's likely that nobody actually saw your press release, or you didn't send it specifically to the reporter, so it went to the assignment desk and they didn't see it. The reporter had 10 other stories to work on that day. And especially now, with the legacy media, as we're calling it, sort of shrinking, everybody's really, really overworked. For every story that I would do at the Chronicle, and this is already going back 10, 15 years, there were 20 stories that I didn't do. And it wasn't that those were bad story ideas, it was just that, you know, I'm one person, Judy's one person covering a huge region, and we can't do all the stories that we'd like to do. So, you know, I think it's often not that some reporter is keeping your story out of the paper. It's that they don't have time. And it's also, as Judy says, also that the stories that we get information on, or the press information that we get, the press releases, they're not framed like stories. They're framed like an event, a month or whatever it is. Usually, or press, something, an opening of the center. They're not, the people who are sending them, the media people are not thinking like reporters. And I think, I'm not thinking of what is the story about that? Why is this important? What's the context of this event that you're telling us about? That's what often reporters don't get from their contacts in the field. And so then it's incumbent upon a reporter, which is our job, to come think about, well, how is that a story? It's obviously easier if someone comes to you with some new take on something, with some new trend. And it doesn't have to be, often something is new to the kind of larger media world, but not new to you in public health. But so you have to think about what's been covered, what information has the larger public gotten? Even if it's something that's a trend in the literature for the last few years, and maybe that nobody knows about it in the mainstream media, and so therefore the word hasn't gotten out. So you have to think about how you can package what you're doing in a way that makes it easier for the journalist to cover it and to see what exactly the story is, not just what the event that you're doing today is.
Just very quickly to piggyback on what you said, stories happen to people. And if your press release or your event doesn't have people involved, then I think your chances of getting covered is a lot less. It's not that we're ignoring your story, you don't want to do your story, but when your story comes to us and it's packaged with some kids and a cute puppy, it's think about what it takes to grab the public's attention. That's what we're trying to do, is in this crowded media cycle, is just get the public's attention for a second, try to tell them something interesting. Press release that says it's ALS month and ALS is a disease, blah, 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 blah. People zone out. But like Judy said, if you find this great person in a nursing home who's doing something amazing, having an amazing personal story, and you send that in your press release, ALS month is maybe at the bottom of the release you don't mention at all, but that person is your vehicle to get coverage of your issue. So next question, please.
Hi, my name is Elena Ong, and I'm the invisible minority. I looked around the room, and my population is 5% of America, and I'm one of probably 200 in this room, maybe 100. But nevertheless, I need to share my story to mainstream media, and I certainly have access to standing clothes with New American Media. And so my concern actually was to make sure that Asians were a visible force in the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and also in the successful implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And I resorted to actually doing my own YouTube type of thing. We just released it, and because of gobbledygook that went in the middle of it, instead of being there on 9/23, which is the 6 month anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, which is what my target date was, because of the death of my family, I had to postpone it, and ironically, the time that I could finally produce it was GOTV weekend. Worst time to get media coverage, type of thing. But nevertheless, what I did is I used my channels within the Asian ethnic, of what the Asian nonprofit organizations, and said, Twitter this, YouTube this, get this out to people. I wrote an article for the American Chronicles, an op-ed piece, to kind of get that out there. And I used my bullet pulpit yesterday to talk to Dr. Ko about what we were doing on the front line, pre and post election. Because here's the opportunity as I see it. We designed a video featuring Yuka Kovan. It's a 2 minute short to basically say, what does the Affordable Care Act mean to me and my community? I left it vanilla, just so that anybody from any vanilla flavor community would be interested in me. And I focused on Asians type of thing. And then we also kind of addressed things that healthcare.gov was not addressing. They were doing all their translations to English and to Spanish speaking. The IRS was doing all their policy pieces on Spanish speaking and English, but no one was doing Asians, despite the fact that I knocked on the doors of every Asian Congress member and every non-Asian Congress member who serves an Asian constituency. So I just want to let you know that's kind of the groundwork that I was doing, and I want to figure out how to best utilize my resources, my assets, so that you will cover it. Because I don't want to always cover my own story. So what I think the important thing is, and I think the angle that I kind of came in on this was, we developed this short to basically teach people how to use healthcare.gov, because before the election, they would at least see the value of it and perhaps vote for the folks who can be in that cause. you know, they voted for it on the floor. We saw the outcome of the election. Guess what? Those folks didn't necessarily win the election. But what we do have is open enrollment during the month of November. And this is an excellent opportunity to get out in language and in culture how people can benefit from the Affordable Care Act and actually use that to choose a health plan that will basically save them dollars so they won't have to pay for a copay. And now that all the insurance commissioners are now in place, and now the governors are in place, and this majority of Republican governors, I think that sets a very interesting story for Bloomberg government, for that matter, type of thing. And so, you know, my interest out there, Dr. Coe's very interested, very grateful for this bid that I put on it, and now I want to fight it. Can you help?
You know, I think my initial reaction is you said you're tired of covering your own story, and I can understand that, but I also see it as a great opportunity. Just a few years ago, if you wanted to get this story out, you know, pre-YouTube, you know, or pre-internet, I don't know how you would have done that. And now there's so many different messages, there's so many different means of getting that message out. And I think if your goal is, it sounds like you have two goals, and one of your goals is to reach the Asian population. And frankly, I know in the state of Colorado, if you're trying to reach the Asian population, you're going to need YouTube, and you're going to need Twitter feeds, and you're going to need input from all the various nonprofits and agencies that are connected to Asians, because I don't think the Denver Post is ever going to do a story about the impact of you're not going to see many stories about Asian health in a state with such a tiny minority of Asian people, you know, just or not. So you have a lot more opportunities. If you're trying, I understand the need to don't want to be the invisible minority anymore, and you need to get these issues out in front of a larger audience. But I really think if you only have $100 to invest in your media, your $100 goes a lot more. You're going to get a lot more bang doing your YouTube video than you are on chasing reporters like us.
Let me just add one more thing. I got advice from the Herndon Lions. Basically, I did a pitch using numbers, because Asians are rated and being rated like numbers. And so I would say, health disparities cost America $1.24 trillion. Did you know that, you know, Asians are 70% insurance rate, 70%, which is greater than what it is for the rest of the population. Korean Americans are 30% insurance rate, which is greater than the rate for Latinos and Native Americans. I mean, I did my numbers. I'm 2.4 million people. That's larger than the number of uninsured people you have in this state.
Right.
So the point is, I'm not...
How many... If you were just, you just rattled off a whole bunch of numbers right there, and I'm a radio guy, and if I rattle off a whole bunch of numbers like that, how many people can identify any of the numbers that she just told us? You know, I mean, you maybe have one or two, but if you have families, here's a Korean family that didn't have insurance before, and they're going to have it now, here are children who are benefiting, here are children who are suffering, then you maybe toss out a couple numbers like that. I think you need to have the numbers for credibility, but you really need the people. If you want to grab the public's attention, you need people to tell stories.
Is for the last speaker, your impact on business reporting, does it project into the future, or does it just do the immediate impact on business? Because it seems like those would be two very different stories, and without the long view, it seems kind of biased towards business from a layperson who's here.
If we have good data, and we have good basis on which to make projections, at least I think a reasonable in terms of how you build a model. We'll do both. We'll talk about the current business environment. We'll talk about current market share, who the main players are. But we will, I would say, to the extent we're comfortable, we will make some kind of an assessment of what we think a reasonable estimate of our impact would be. It's not to say that those will be the winners and losers, but it's more importantly, it's giving business community and government officials some sense of context of what is it you just did, or that you're thinking about doing, in terms of trying to translate that and quantify it.
Right, but your phrase was the 20,000 feet above look, giving that a real, you know, close-up look. Well, I think government is focused on that long-range vision of a successful population, including business. And so if this is the translation that's being given to businesses about this policy, it seems like even if data are not, you know, accessible to the Bloomberg folks, but this is the thinking. It seems like it would be great if you included both perspectives in that translation, the long vision success of the country and the impact on individual businesses.
I think we try to do both. And if you have suggestions of how we can do it better or be more inclusive, I mean, we are, our interest is just to get it right and as accurate as we can. So if there's better ways of building the models we do, I'm totally receptive to that idea.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Hi, I think my question follows up on what she was saying. I work in tobacco prevention in the state of Oregon, and so I'm really keyed into the example that you were given at the end about the impacts of people quitting smoking, the business impacts. I totally understand the importance of, for example, somebody like me in public health making that pitch to the business community in such a way that they're going to buy into it. And again, one question I guess I have is, who, can you give me some examples of who your audience is in the Bloomberg government? Are we talking about Fortune 500? Are we talking about the tobacco industry? Clearly, like Pfizer, the company that's making Chantix, is going to benefit from people quitting smoking, as would GlaxoSmithKline. Insurers, you know, fronts, going back to the long-term effects, the insurance industry is certainly going to benefit as people are quitting smoking more and more. You know, is that part of the business case that's being made? And I guess it's a red flag for me thinking, oh great, the tobacco industry is really keying into how their bottom line is going to be affected by people quitting smoking. How can we continue our business to so people continue to be addicted to tobacco? And just so I guess you have a context, me being in tobacco prevention education, my husband's a cardiologist, so we have this back and forth joking relationship that I'm trying to put him out of business. At the same time, he always says, as a cardiologist, there's always going to be business with him, whether it's tobacco use or obesity or whatever the chronic disease of the day may be.
I'm not really sure what the question, the whole question, but in terms of listening to who the audience is.
Right, I would like to who the audience is, and then who can actually access articles on Bloomberg. Is this like a subscription
Bloomberg
kind of
government
thing?
Right now is a subscription service. Although some of the stories do run on the Bloomberg Newswire, and you go, and they're also available to Bloomberg News, radio, our print publications like Bloomberg Newsweek, and others. But there is some content that, unless you're a subscriber, is only available on the subscription news service. In terms of the audience, I mean, it's kind of growing all the time, but it is, I would say, for the most part, it is everybody you expect to be interested in kind of government policy issues within kind of Beltway community. It's members of Congress and their staffs, it's executive branch, it's all the consulting firms, PR firms, law firms, advocacy groups, nonprofits, foundations, and then really anybody in the business community that we could, whether it's Fortune 500, Fortune 5,000, down to, you know, as many small businesses as possible, I think, because what we're trying to do is have as big a reach as possible in terms of really trying to translate for all these different audiences, what is going on, and make it more accessible to people, and transparent to people.
One follow-up question. I mean, this whole conference, the theme is social justice and the importance of advocating for health disparities and inequalities. So how can we, as public health people, get that important message to the business community of health disparities and help us address that?
I would say, at least from where I sit, it's, we can talk about it, but I have to be able to quantify it. I have to be able to talk specifically about how does this disparity impact either this industry, this company, in terms of the broad economic impact. The more specific I can make it, the more detailed I can make it, it really gets some numbers, and even if it's just a like almost like a case study of specific business in a specific community, this is what has happened, and this is how it's played out over the course of the past few years or few months, and this policy change is coming along, and it's going to have this impact, or the lack of policy or the lack of some of funding or whatever, the more specific I can make it, the better chance I have to be able to convince my editors to be able to go forward with that.
So, for instance, you know, just again bringing it home to Chicago, where there are enormous disparities, of course, you know, with poor people having worse healthcare outcomes. Who's paying for that? Well, taxpayers are paying for that to the extent that they're funding public health services, you know, whether it be the Cook County Health System, whatever. You're paying through your insurance premium because there's a cost shift that occurs when somebody shows up at an emergency room in dreadful health because they lack primary care. Somebody pays for that ultimately. None of this is free. So part of how you make a case to somebody like Matt is you present it in those terms. You know, the dollars and cents are, the financial side of it is there. It's always part of what's going on. Somebody is paying for everything that goes on. You know, whenever somebody seeks care, and then there are enormous costs also associated with people who don't seek care in terms of the spread of infectious disease, et cetera, and so forth. You know, how do you quantify that? A little bit harder, but you think in those terms.
Yeah, and I would just add, I mean, it sounds crass, but with Bloomberg News, Bloomberg government, for the most part, it's not going to cover kind of the human interest piece of this. It's not going to cover the compelling story, which is a great news piece. It has its own value, but in terms of what we're focused on, what we're going to, what our readers are going to be interested in, it is going to be the nuts and bolts of the specific details of how this plays out. I mean, we may touch on some of that, some of the human elements of it, but it's not going to be the sole focus of it. So, I mean, there's other outlets I think you can go to where you have a more receptive audience for that.
So I did a story, for instance, when Ted Kennedy got, you know, his brain tumor. I found a young man who had the same brain tumor, who was homeless and uninsured. And I wrote about the differences in the kind of care that Kennedy was able to get versus the differences that this young man was able to get. That's what Matt won't do, but the mainstream media will do. And then there are other opportunities, of course, available in the non-traditional media.
I think one thing that's really important to keep in mind, you know, a lot of the press releases I get, obviously someone pushed a button and it went to 1,000 different reporters. Now that's useful, I guess, to get if you want to hit a lot of different people. But, you know, pitches work best if they're sort of tailored to the particular audience and market that reporter is working in. And so you really need to think, who is the audience that they're appealing to? And then sort of step back and, okay, so to appeal to this reporter, I have to sort of show that I'm sort of thinking to some degree about the audience that they're writing for. And without that, sending a press release is kind of useless, except as a tidbit of information that I may use in some story 6 months down the line. But as a way to prompt me to do a story now, if I don't get a sense that your pitch has anything to do with the audience that, say, I'm writing for, you know, all it just shows me is that you're not sending it to me in particular, you're just sending it to whoever. Like, you know, throwing spaghetti on a wall, if it sticks, it does. You know, if it doesn't, it doesn't. And that's what most press releases at this point.
I'm going to venture a guess that a press release saying state tobacco policy is socially unjust and disproportionately affects minority populations is probably dead on arrival at Bloomberg. But if it comes from the point of view of if we've done some legwork and we figured out that this tobacco policy that we don't like has financial impacts, that health insurance companies in Colorado are losing, or your health insurance rates are 5% higher because of state tobacco policy, that's a story for him. And that may or may not be a policy for folks like us working in legacy media, but if you come to us with those good, hard numbers and a compelling case, and a family that says these people are suffering, here's a taxpayer who's a small business that went out of business, then you have a human interest story too. So next question, please.
Okay, great. I do appreciate you coming in and telling us how it is as opposed to how we like it to be. And to all my public health colleagues, I think what you're hearing here is we're very good at tailoring a message to an audience. You don't tell a 14-year-old that in 30 years you may have trouble having an erection, so you shouldn't start smoking. You figure out what works for them. Well, this is the audience here, folks, that we need to work with. And we just can't tell you, but you need to cover the story like this because it's really important. That's not good enough when you apply some of our public health principles. I do want to ask a question. This applies because I've done this for a bunch of years in my state on a local, regional basis, dealing with the newspapers.
the story? And does that help you when you make a pitch to the editor? Because he says, well, or she says, well, I already, you know, I met with some folks from the public health group, and they talked about this sort of broad issue. There wasn't a story at that time, but now there is a story. So we created sort of a parity ground for you. Is there anything to that?
Well, I would say that those are two different things. I mean, meeting with the editorial board doesn't really necessarily have anything to do with dealing with the reporters because they're separate entities. So it may help you in terms of getting your message out. I mean, it's definitely, I think, always useful to meet with the editorial board, unless it's a really stupid editorial board, like the one that used to be at the Chronicle when I started working there. And at that point, it was like about X reporters, you know, like 10 X, you know, 10 aging white men all 80 years old. So at that point, it was not that useful to meet with. But in general, it's a very good idea. It is a very good idea to establish an ongoing relationship with the reporter whose work you like, or with an editor that's kind of overseeing the health and science reporters, if there is such a person at the outlet. But you know, it's really the long-term relationship with the reporter that, in the end, helps you sort of get coverage, where you sort of meet with them, or you talk with them, and you know, they become a source for them. You don't mind if they call you up for background information for some other story you're writing that won't mention your agency or your project, because then the next time they'll come to you when they do have something that they want to write about that involves you. So establishing relationships is always good, if only because then when you send a press release, you know that person's going to actually look at it. I mean, I think I pay much more attention to a release that I get from somebody I've dealt with before, that I know that their information is reliable. You know, and that it may result in a good story, than somebody who sends me something and I have no idea who they are or where it's coming from, just, you know, because I'm a human being and I feel more comfortable dealing with people that I already know. So establishing relationships is great, but don't count on establishing relations with the editorial board resulting in better coverage in the news section of the paper.
And even on the issue of establishing relationships, I have people call me all the time and say, can I come in for 10 minutes? Can we have coffee? And almost inevitably, I say no. Because, as David said, we are so busy. Now, if it is an organization I know I'm going to be dealing with over time, yes, I do. It's all about relationships. So whether it's the hospital association or the medical society or, you know, the Cook County system or whatever, I will take time. But if it's somebody coming to sell me a product or if it's a one-time deal, I will not make time for you. I have to be convinced that this is worth my time, and that's part of your job, I guess.
So what's the best way of convincing you that we're great sources?
I would have
future stories, so that you would want to establish a long-term relationship, besides the agency you work in. Is there another way of establishing or bona fides the way you say, well, this is the person I may want, I want my Rolodex, I get a call when a story comes down 6 months later?
Be available, and you know, I think there's lots of different ways to make that initial contact, and you know, I've done stories where I don't know how many different public health departments there are, you know, there's more than 60 in the state of Colorado, and if during the flu outbreak, I happened to make a really good connection. I covered an event, a vaccination event, and struck up a conversation with the head of the Tri-County Health Department, and we talked, and I got to know what his areas of expertise and interests are, what he thinks, you know, I asked him questions about what he thinks the big issues are, so I know where he's coming from, what he's interested in, and that's just one example. So, you know, anytime that door is open, you have a chance to buttonhole a reporter and establish some kind of rapport with them. I think it's a good thing.
It helps to know if you're knowledgeable and well-connected. For instance, you know, are you an expert in children's issues? Are you an expert in aging issues? Are you an expert in infectious diseases? So that the next time something comes up and I'm not sure exactly where to go, I can pick up the phone and say, I think I got something here. Can you talk about it? Or do you know anybody who might be able to help me? And over time, we learn how to work together.
Right. I would just add, it's a little unique here. It's like, do you have data? I want to talk to you.
Right. Yeah, and this, I think.
You figure that out, but it's got to be reliable, incredible.
Right.
If it's not, you know, I'm not going to use it. And it may come back to bite you.
National,
yes, but we will use state, local, company-specific data fields to illustrate the impact of something that may be at a national level. This is how it's playing out in Colorado, in Denver, and Denver.
To me, I have a bias toward public health, but I think one of the inherent strengths you have is your credibility, because you do, you know, the rock solid science, and you have real data. You don't just have a bunch of shouting talking heads and opinions. You can point to studies and you can walk reporters through them and show them, hey, this is good information. You want to report truth. This is as close as we can get. You were a good source for doing that.
One good strategy that has worked with me is that I have a story appear, and then someone contacts me. Sort of is interesting. Here's another aspect that you may not have, thought about. But again, it shouldn't be often. I get those things, and either they pitch in the exact same story that I just wrote, in which case I'm not going to do another story right away on the same thing, or they pitch me a specific product that they're selling that would somehow help in this domain that I've kind of written about. That's also not very interesting to me. But as Dewey says, if you come up, two things. One, pitch me a good story that gets my attention, and then I will probably come to you again for stories. And if I do a story, set yourself up, convince me that you're somebody that has knowledge in that area, so that the next time I do think about contacting you.
I think the overarching message is that public health agencies need to know their media market as well as, the demographics of your community and the health indicators in your community. You need to know who's doing, which organizations are doing health stories and which ones aren't. And of those organizations that are, find those reporters and talk to them and find out what their interests are and what kind of stories they're likely to do and which ones they're not likely to do. And you'll save a lot of time sending pitches that don't get a response.
I work in a smaller media market, so it's not San Francisco or Chicago, and of course our reporters are not dedicated health reporters frequently with clients back Fort Collins, about 60 miles north of here. We're actually having a meningococcal meningitis outbreak that's fairly severe, and I just got a text message from a professor in town going, why do those reporters keep calling these bacteria viruses? So I don't have a solution for, what do you do when you have a health reporter who doesn't really know that much. My real question is, we could easily get, we can put out stories, but we can't preferentially put out stories to one media outlet than another. And we can't, I could get a blog on health for our local paper, but then the other papers would say, why are you doing that? Instead of writing a whole press release, would it be better use of our time to send out maybe a short blurb saying, we think this would make a really interesting story and it might want to take this approach.
That is a press release, by the way.
Well, yeah. ours are probably more like the ones that people have described as the ones that everybody throws away,
right,
most likely. But, I mean,
let me.
I'm just wondering if the short message that the reporter really needs to do the writing and the work on, which would save us time, would be a better approach than a full-blown press release.
Let me just jump in here real quickly. I think it goes back to relationships, and on your first issue of when reporters are talking about this terrible meningococcal bacteria or virus, or they're scrambling their terminology. If you have a relationship with that reporter, then you can call them and gently, diplomatically let them know that viruses and bacteria are actually different. Just have a friendly little conversation, and I wouldn't beat them about the head and neck with it, because you're going to need that person further down the line. And I hate to stand up here and defend the media, because there's so much about it that's impossible to defend. But again, it's the relationships. If you know who's likely to cover or not, then you'll have better chances of getting your story covered. And I think, coming from a rural background myself in Colorado, there are lots of newspapers out there that would be really happy to get a monthly column, or you can go ahead and write the health report and send it to these small town papers, and they'll put it on there with your byline on it. They won't filter it through a reporter. So that's another option too. All right, thanks everyone for your questions and for listening. Thanks for coming.